Hello, and welcome to the Warlord Spotlight on the Comic Book Page Podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be spotlighting the Warlord series from DC Comics. In this Warlord Spotlight, I'm joined by James, and we're going to be discussing Warlord number 48 to 51 from 1981. James, how are you doing tonight?
I am fantastic. Other than being a little sleepy, I'm really good. How about you, John?
I'm doing okay. A little tired. Been a rough week, but I'm doing all right. And we had a little more reading this time. We're up to the 50 Cent issues. I forget when they flipped over. But we've got the main story. We've got backup features. We've got a bonus book in one of these.
Yep.
So these are getting to be a little meatier issues at this point.
Yeah, they used to be really breezy, and I was like, oh my gosh, there's a lot to this one.
Well, the lead story is still usually about the 17 pages or so, but once you add in the 8 or whatever for the backup, and one or two cases, a 16-page preview of another title and stuff, it adds up.
Yeah, it really does. And I say that with the material, I enjoyed all of it, but I go into them almost thinking, okay, this is going to be a quick issue. And I was surprised. I was like, oh, wait a minute, it's not quick.
Yeah, I have one or two. It's like, there's a lot in here, which is good. Yeah. Good problem to have.
It is a good problem to have. And by the way, I wanted to just get this out of the way at the very beginning. How cool is it that we just found out Mike Grell posted that they're going to release Warlord, his run of Warlord, in two omnibus editions at DC. And then to be seen, you know, for the other maybe three volumes with the other material. I don't know. They might do the whole 5-volume run.
I think it's about time. I think this is some great material, and they should have had collected editions before now. I probably would have gone the trade route just to get it in more hands sooner.
Yeah.
But at least they're getting it out, and I think Omnibus is a great choice.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, we kind of theorized, we're like, oh, they never print this stuff, and they released those issues digitally, and then they stopped DC. And I think they may have stopped because they saw so much popularity behind this. They're like, let's not kill the sales on this omnibus. Let's rock and roll with it. So it's different than the route we are going that nobody liked it.
Interesting theory. I was taking it as if you've got to get it production ready to print anyways, why not put it up there? But you've got a good point of if they do put it up there, who would pay for the omnibus?
Yeah. Oh, I got it digitally and I'm paying this anyways. I can save some money. So I think before they release it all digitally, they saw there's enough interest. That's my conspiracy theory. And it may be right.
It might be. I don't know. That would signify to me a shift in thinking on their part, which is not a bad thing and not a bad plan, but we'll see what happens.
Just out of curiosity, before we jump into this, are you going to be picking it up, the omnibus? Because I know you have the single issues and stuff. I didn't know if this is a double dipper for you.
I'll certainly have to think about it. Certainly, if there's any bonus features or whatever, that would be in its favor. It depends if how expensive it is, if it looks like a good collection, whatever.
Cool.
In other words, it's not a clear-cut decision either way. And if it's a slow month otherwise, that makes it a lot easier decision. If it's a really busy month, other big-ticket items, it's not in its favor.
That makes sense. Okay, cool.
So, you? I take it you're going to get it?
Oh, heck yeah. You're going to get a preview spotlight clip, too.
Cool.
It's coming.
Awesome. Awesome. I hope they not only do Grell's run, but continue on after that.
That's what I'm hoping to, because they've already said the 2 volumes Grell announced his, but I'm hoping they collect it all. He just didn't want to announce for anyone else. Any of the other creators who may want to jump in and say something.
Probably doesn't care about the rest, to be honest.
Or, yeah, the hell with it. This is what I wrote.
Exactly. It's his stuff, and it's other people's stuff to do as they please. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, shall we dive into issue 48?
Yeah, let's do that. Dragon of Ice.
Yeah. Now, we've got the lead story, then we'll get to the backup, then we'll get to the bonus book and stuff. And we pick up with Eitan, and it took me a bit to recognize him at first, but reporting back to Tara that Travis has gone into the Land of Shadows, which apparently has a bit of a reputation as a not great place to go.
Yes.
To go look for Jennifer and all this stuff.
Yes. And that was kind of cool because like Eitan, they're going back to it. We've seen him here and there, but I like to see the cast of characters because he's one I enjoy. And of course, Tara we enjoy. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of just been Travis and
Shakira.
And Shakira, yeah.
I think it would have been fun if we'd gotten a side story with Eitan and Tara before they got where they were going.
That would have been cool.
And that's something they could have always done as a later backup feature or something like that, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I would like that.
But, you know, he presents to her, here's what's going on. She's like, I got to think about it. And then the next thing he knows, she's basically leaving saying, yeah, I'm not your majesty right now. I'm just Tara. Hop on the horse. We're going to go find Travis.
Exactly.
And he's like, okay.
And Travis, by the way, finds a cult in this little town that he's looking at, which was kind of cool.
I loved the interplay between Travis and Shakira, because they find the cult. They've got the sacrifice they're about to do. And Shakira's like, yeah, let's just go to the next village. He's like, uh-uh, can't do that. Can't let the lady die.
I like that, too. They really have some nice interaction, nice play with each other. I liked it.
And then with his pistol from a great distance away, he shoots the guy who was going to do the sacrifice.
And there's no scope on that gun. And he is a better shot than pretty much anyone in the world, I think.
Yeah, that was an insane shot. But he was braced up against a rock, you know, slow, steady, able to line it up, took his time, I think. So it's not like he just pulled it up and blam.
Correct.
But he then goes on horseback and waylays into everybody else there. And I love how we get the shot with a horse that's got the unicorn kind of spike or whatever on his armor. And the horse takes a guy out.
Yeah, that was awesome. The horse is actually kind of a battle horse. He uses the horn in battle. I loved it.
You'd think at this point the horse would have gotten a name. I don't think we've named this one.
No, we didn't. It's just horse.
Because we had Pegasus, and that one got a name, I think.
Yeah, so I'm surprised we don't have a name for this horse now that you mention it.
Yeah.
But I loved how we go in, and the warlord's going to save the maiden in distress, the damsel in distress. And how the whole story flips on its head right there. Boom.
Oh, yeah. He's like, she's under the protection of Travis Morgan. Bonk. And I love the shot of Shakira just rolling her eyes like, yep, knew it was going to happen.
That was awesome. She's like, hey, you idiot. This is kind of like their gig. She's willingly doing this. And she let him figure out the hard way.
Well, yeah. I mean, the ice dragon is coming. They've got to do a sacrifice for the ice dragon. Here's this interloper. Let's use him for the sacrifice.
There we go. She was going to do it willingly. Now you're going to be the sacrifice.
It's amazing how many times that Travis sees somebody in need, leaps without really looking or thinking, gets in trouble, gets held captive, has to get rescued. In this case, Shakira comes to the rescue and turns out to be a crack shot with the pistol.
Yeah.
And I love her comment of, it's not as hard as you make it look kind of a thing.
Exactly. It was awesome.
I also love it when the ice dragon actually comes and he's like, wait, that's real?
And it turns out to be a Viking ship.
Yeah, that was kind of wild.
Yeah, I did not expect that. And them being frozen was kind of interesting, which they went to a whole, like some exposition saying, hey, these people must have found a way to get into this world's Skitaris, these Vikings, because they exist on the outside world and things like that.
Yeah, and like it's getting stuck in this pattern where it comes by shore, it gets pushed out, and then loops back around and just keeps doing it every so often or whatever.
Yeah, and it never attacks, but the people have created this whole mythos around it based on the cycle, which, you know, you get mythos that have been formed around the Earth's orbit and axis, you know, and short days and long days. You have, you know, ancient pagan rituals that take place.
Yeah, we have no idea how long this has been going on, but clearly hundreds of years, but time works funny in Skartaris.
It really does, so we don't know.
So for all we know, for these guys who've been frozen over on the boat, they could have just had that happen.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, and then Travis literally just flips the altar. Never again, this will not happen. People aren't going to get sacrificed to the frozen Vikings, basically.
And Shakira's like, that's not really going to change anything.
Yeah.
Again, the interplay between those two is great.
It's cool. Yeah, it was really cool. And then they had that little backup with, I can't remember the guy's name.
At this point, he has not been named. This is the guy.
The guy. He does get a name later on.
Yes.
And he's with Jennifer, and you literally just see her bathing, which was, I was like, oh, that's interesting.
They've gotten to his master's house, and he's got the box. He's putting the box down. She gets to go clean up, because she hasn't had that in a while. And we find out there's something evil.
Da, da, da.
Exactly. And I thought it was interesting.
I did too. And I liked this story. It wasn't one of the best stories, but I did enjoy it.
Yeah, yeah. I would agree it wasn't one of the best. Certainly not one of the worst. And again, it hit a number of story beats over the course of the 17 or so pages. move things along on a couple of different plot lines. Really, we had Jennifer's stuff progress, obviously Travis's and Shakira's stuff progress, and we got some good stuff with Eitan and Tara. So, again, most of the active cast at this point, something happened and moved forward. I like that.
I liked it too.
Now, we get a backup feature here.
Claw, the Unconquered?
Yeah.
What'd you think of that?
Well, first off, Claw the Unconquered 1 through 9 came out in 1975 to 1976-ish, and then 10 through 12 came out in like 1978, May to September-ish, thereabouts. Mm-hmm. And apparently the goal of this backup was to kind of wrap up the unfinished storyline from that series from years past, keeping in mind this came out around April 1981.
Oh, okay. All right. So I did not know that Claw had been something that was out there before.
I did not care that Claw had been something out there before because I hadn't read the stuff.
Oh, yeah. I enjoyed this for what it was. It was something that, you know, I felt like, what was that backup that we didn't enjoy? OMAC. I felt like that wasn't in the Warlord genre, and this felt like more appropriate for the book.
OMAC was definitely a sci-fi kind of a thing.
Yes.
This is much more fantasy adventure kind of a thing.
Yeah, it fit the book. This is me. Okay, so I'm a sword and sorcery guy. I'm the Conan reader. So if I'm picking up Warlord, which at the time was DC's kind of Conan-ish book, this works for me. So I was reading it. I was like, hey, all right, this is cool. I can dig this.
This is a blatantly supernatural kind of a Conan because Claw's thing is his right hand is that of a demon.
Yeah, like a furry hand.
And apparently at this point, he lopped it off. I don't know if that was the end of the other series or what, but we start with, you know, I'm ready to die. I've severed the hand and I'm free of it. Only to find it quickly crawled back on and reattached itself.
That was interesting. First time we saw it, I'm like, okay, why is his hand clawing, climbing up? And boom, it's back on.
Yeah, it definitely hits the ground running on this. And then we get an intervention from, I guess, one of the Lords of Light, maybe?
That's what I was thinking, something like that. It's not said, but that's how I took it.
And it's like, your story's not done. Go fight the good fight. Here's a shield. Here's a helmet. And, you know, go take over these cities in our name and in your name, too, of course. You know, go be the hero you need to be kind of a deal.
Yeah, he literally is riding on a almost like a light bridge, which is the equivalent of the Asgard having that rainbow bridge.
Right, the Bifrost, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what it reminded me of. And he's off the battle where the humans are fighting the demons. And he has the one demon hand, which helps him have a little bit of a power, you know, crushing people's faces.
Well, and I love, he sees the fight, he goes in, he asks why the demons are attacking, gets a little bit of backstory on that, not that it matters. He goes, he fights, and then we end this on basically the general of the demons setting up a one-on-one with him, taking off his gauntlet and showing a human hand of, you know, it's time for a reckoning. So we see the flip side of the demon who got the human hand.
Yeah, and it was so corny, but at the same time, it completely worked.
And they covered all of that in 8 pages.
Which was amazing, wasn't it?
Well, I'm sure at some point I've read some Claw stuff, because I'm sure they reprinted that in one of the digests or something like that I got, you know, literally 100 or 2 of back in the day. But I'm not a Claw fan. So for them to basically go from, you know, we're starting the story to we're going to end on a cliffhanger, set the scene of the world, the character, set the stakes and stuff, I was impressed how much they did here.
It was insane how much content. This was probably 2 or 3 issues today, and we got it in 8 pages.
Yeah.
Like with what happened in here and the momentum, it's just crazy. And you're going to have the showdown between the demon with the human hand versus the human with the demon hand on the next issue.
Well, and there's a fair amount of exposition in this, but you kind of have to. And it still felt more in the moment, more action-y and stuff than that first installment of OMAC.
It really did. This worked for me, and I thought it was fun. And it made me a fan of Claw for what little I've seen of him.
I had a feeling you were going to like Claw.
Oh, I really did.
It's very much in that Conan kind of area, that genre and stuff, while making it its own by adding the demons and the claw hand and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. It was a ton of fun. I think people who like stuff like me, like the Conan stuff, would enjoy this for what it is. I mean, it's an 8-page story, so there's that, but you get a lot in the 8 pages.
Yeah. What did you think of Erak, Son of Thunder?
I really enjoyed all 3 of these, too. Because Eric, Son of Thunder, is Roy Thomas, who was writing a lot of Conan stuff, and it worked for me. This one, I would say, is more text and prose heavy.
Yes.
So there was a ton of dialogue, and that's the part that I didn't like as much.
A ton of captions.
A ton of captions, yeah. Not dialogue, captions.
It takes a good couple of pages before anybody speaks.
Yes. So it was text heavy. Even when they're speaking, it was text heavy. And did this not remind you, well, you never read Savage Sword of Conan, but the lady that they show in here bathing and stuff, like just her hair's covering, you know, her private parts. And that reminded me so much of like that risque Savage Sword of Conan type stuff. I was like, wow, DC's riding the edge here. And it brought me back to, I don't want to say my childhood, like a depraved childhood, but like to that young kid who's like, oh, wow, there's girls in here. That it was awesome. I was like, wow, this is kind of cool.
Yeah, I thought it was fun. It's a little in the Conan riff. It's a little on the Turok, Son of Thunder kind of a thing.
That's the perfect mashup.
Son of Stone, this is Son of Thunder.
Yep.
I'd like to meet Eric's father, Thunder, I'm just saying. This did wind up spinning out into a 25-issue series, I believe.
Yeah, because I've seen those books from DC. I never read them, but I've seen the covers and stuff, so I know this must have been a popular one.
Yeah, popular enough to last for about 2 years, but not popular enough to go longer than that.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I mean, in 2 years is not a bad run at that point, because there were a number of things that ran, I don't know, 6-7 issues or 15 issues or whatever, because we're not too far past the DC implosion of the late 70s.
Yeah, and this one had the notes and tones, like you said, Turok and of Conan, mixed with, you know, Conan has that stuff where you have, like, demons from time to time and monsters. Mm-hmm. And so you literally get a monster that's created from this pile of gold that's sitting there, you know, when they're going after the gold.
Yeah. Well, and the art by Ernie Colon is some great stuff, too.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, literally, this is, I want to say, one of my favorite issues of Warlord, and not necessarily because of the Warlord story, but because I really enjoyed all three stories, even though you're getting a ton of material in here.
Well, again, for the 50-cent cover price,
that's a hell of a deal.
Yeah, you got a 17-page lead story, an 8-page backup story, a 15-page bonus story. I mean, that's hard to go wrong with. And they're all of the same basic genre without being duplicate of each other.
Exactly. That's where I think they hit the magic, is they kept it all something for the Warlord fan versus just tacking on something that you wouldn't enjoy. I read this, I'm like, man, this feels similar. Not the same, but similar. And I'm like, Roy Thomas, oh my gosh, you know, they got great writers. Ernie Colon, oh my gosh, that's awesome. So I was a little bit excited that I'm reading this for the first time, and yet it feels retro and it feels familiar and very weird. I really enjoyed this issue, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but a fun issue for me.
Well, and it's funny because we've had the 50-cent issues since number, I think, 37, where we started getting the OMAC backup and stuff like that. But I think this is one of the first ones where I felt we really got the value of that additional dime, because the backup feature, again, was towards the same target audience.
Yes, I agree. And this is what they need to do if they're going to do a backup. Introduce something new if it's going to be newer, and make it of the same genre and ilk, and then people will enjoy it and not feel ripped off. And then I'm also curious, when they do the omnibus stuff, because this is not my grail, will they include this? I don't know.
I don't think so. I wouldn't personally. I would just include the Warlord stuff.
That's what I think they're going to do. They'll leave this off.
I'm trying to think if there's anything I've gotten that's an omnibus of material from DC that had backup features.
Yeah. The only thing I can tell you that was kind of interesting is Savage Tales was the first before Savage Sword of Conan. And it had a Conan story, but it had some other stories in there. Mm-hmm. And so the very first volume of Savage Sword of Conan, this is Marvel, they included all those side stories from the first issue, which was kind of cool because I appreciate it. It's like, wow, this is kind of cool. But immediately with Savage Tales number 2, they went just to Conan. So they did it for one issue and not the others, I think, if I'm remembering correctly.
Well, like for Warlord, I would include the backups that are the Wizard World stuff.
Yeah.
Because that's germane to the Warlord material.
Yeah, exactly. And Grell did that. So,
but Claw, certainly the Arak thing is a bonus book and not even a backup. I would not expect or necessarily want those in the omnibus.
Yeah. And the only way I could see them even keeping is if they said, oh, this is where, you know, how certain issues were a retelling of issue one. We'll stick this material in here because we're skipping this issue because it was a retelling of issue number one. But I don't think they're going to do that.
Yeah, but that's going to cause some people confusion as to why are they skipping, you know, issue 51 and whatever and stuff. Why don't we get the full run? It's like, you are. There's nothing new in those.
Yeah, it's literally a reprint.
But I also think there's an opportunity for them to take, like, the Claw stuff or the OMAC material and reprint that as a trade or something.
Yeah, and if they do that, I'd be happy because that's something that I would recommend to fans of Warlord and maybe Conan. Hey, check out this Arrak stuff or check out this Claw stuff. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and with Arrak, they could do that entire thing in a single omnibus if they wanted to.
Yeah. Hey, Roy Thomas, I'll be on board for it.
Yeah. He's a great writer.
Yeah, I like him. I'm a fan of his.
I'm generally a fan. I'll be honest. Some of the stuff he's done more recently, like trying to claim a certain ownership of Wolverine and whatnot.
Yeah.
I get, but I kind of disagree with and I'm not a fan of.
That I can understand. Yes.
I don't think editors should be doing that.
Me neither. You're an editor. You are not a creator of it. Yeah.
Yeah. But I love Roy Thomas's Earth 2 stuff and a ton of his other work. So yeah, definitely a fan of his writing.
Yeah, me too.
Well, shall we move on to Warlord number 49?
Yeah, 49. We're up to 50 cent issue, but we are only getting one backup in this one.
Well, again, the other was a bonus book that, yes. You know, what they were doing at the time is those things were floating. There'd be one in, like, DC Comics Presents that launched New Teen Titans, another one over in, I'm trying to think where they did the Captain Carrot one. But there have been a couple where it would just show up somewhere and, you know, launch another book that way or something.
Which is kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. So the crux of this issue is Shakira betting Morgan that he can't go all day without using his gun.
Yeah, I love that. I also loved how she was down like a cat in her human form, drinking from the water. Like, I could picture her licking it.
Yeah, I loved that. Again, it goes to she is a cat in human form.
Yeah, exactly. I love that.
There's so much evidence pointing to that. It's not even funny.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting when we get past the Grell run on Warlord, if that changes.
Yeah, I'm interested to see too. But I like how they made a whole wager out of this. Hey, you rely on this pistol so much. Let's see if you can go, I can't remember the period of time they chose, without using it. You're not allowed to use the gun.
Until they make camp again, which I took to be, you know, the
a day. Yeah, however long the day is in Skitaris.
Now, it turns out where they had camped overnight was just below some fortress, castle, something or other.
Yeah, something.
And it's a, let's go explore, because why not? And then when it's like, oh, there are all these warnings saying the evil one is here, get the hell away. Let's go explore. It's like, jeez.
Come on. I mean, there's literally a skull on a pike and there's little demons running around. I wouldn't want to explore until the sun is out, you know, but the sun doesn't come out here. So there is that.
It doesn't set here.
It doesn't set. That's what it, yeah.
Yeah. What I also didn't care for was we then got the bottom panel from pages, what, 4 to 13 or something, of being a little Wizard World featurette.
Yeah.
I did not like that. I don't like parallel stories told that way. I mean, I get what they were doing, but it's like, am I reading the Warlord stuff? Am I reading this? And I got to keep context switching.
Yeah. You either have to read it or go back and read it all together to make it make more sense. Because I was reading as I went, and it made sense.
Yeah.
But it made more sense when I went back to page one and read each page, page by page, which is a little bit annoying.
Yeah. I mean, I get why they did it the way they did. I think when we'd first gotten the Wizard World stuff and they did this sort of a thing back, then it paralleled the current day story better.
Yeah.
And I love how they get in there, they see another trap or two, and the first thing Travis does is pull out the gun.
Yeah. It's like, come on, man, you just made the wager. And he's going for the gun.
And she's like, oh, so quick. He's like, oh, no, I'll do it. You know, and again, that goes to the rapport between the two of them.
Yeah, there's really fun interaction between them. But yeah, Shakira definitely wins the bet. And then it's going to be like, I'll decide what I want to do or what I want.
Yeah. Well, and they go through the course of this trap after trap after trap. We get the leopard or whatever showing up in there wanting food and stuff. So we know what, you know, is going to come down the pike once they get past all the traps. We're finding about the evil tome and stuff, and there's this guy who got skewered as he's near the control panel or whatever.
Yeah.
And is he trying to remove this from the altar or put it in there? And of course Travis is like, oh well, maybe he's putting it in there. Let's do that. And I'm like, oh jeez, that's a gutsy call.
Yeah, yeah. And you have a nice little fight between Travis and a giant mummy. We'll call it that.
Yeah, a giant mummy that seems to be filled with sand, dust.
Exactly, because he lops off a hand with a sword and sand is pouring out. So means he's a very heavy dummy. If he hits you, it's going to hurt.
Yeah, but a very fragile one, because all you got to do is puncture him a few times and he'll drain out the sand or something.
Which did happen.
But concurrently, we're getting some backstory on the evil one and how he has subjugated Sargon, who we had met in the Wizard World featurette, I forget which issue, but a little ways back.
Yeah. And did you like how the bet turned out, though, with the jaguar or panther or whatever it was that jumped out?
Again, I thought that was a little telegraphed when we'd seen it before and him just, you know, pulling, shooting without even thinking. It shows, I mean, that's what he would do, and I'm glad he didn't stop, because if he did, he'd be dead. But her basically using the whole thing to just lighten him up a little bit, I liked.
I like that. And she ends it with, like, saying, let's just say you owe me, which works for me because that can come up as, you know, as to the writer's discretion. I'm sure he has a plan, you know, in the future, but you can almost play with it. You know, she could bring it up from time to time. Oh, not yet. You know, oh, not yet.
Well, and with these two, there's almost nothing she could ask that he wouldn't have been doing for her anyways. Because he considers her under his protection and, you know, that kind of a thing. They're family to a degree.
Yeah, family. I was going to say best friends, but family's a better way of putting it. It's almost like a daughter that he didn't have. You know, he has a daughter, but yet he can play with her as far as, like, adventuring. You know, he's not as protective with her. He is protective, but not as his own daughter.
He's protective, but not, I was going to say mothering, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, fathering. Or
fathering,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
They're comrades in arms. He respects her, knows she's capable, but still isn't going to let anyone mess with her, but also knows she can take care of herself.
Exactly. That's a perfect way of putting it.
So I think it was a great issue for the interplay between the two. And then the epilogue.
The epilogue with the reveal of the head with a hand.
That was just creepy.
Yeah, that was funny and creepy.
That was just kind of wild.
Yeah. And for people... This is kind of spoiler-filled because we're doing a back-issue spotlight. It's literally Demios' head mounted on his hand. Just the hand is the neck. And so he runs around on his hand, basically. The little fingers move. It's just really creepy. And it worked for me.
Yeah, I mean, think the thing from the Addams Family, just the right hand or whatever, and plop a head on top of it.
That's it.
It's creepy.
Yeah.
So, it's, yeah. But again, I'm not surprised he came back. I'd have to go back and read his demise to know, because I thought the hand was lopped off. I forget what happened to the head. I don't know how they kind of got melded together.
I remember he almost got decimated. I don't know how this amalgamation came about. And they reiterate in here, his body is gone, you know? So,
yeah.
This guy has multiple lives. He's like a cat, too.
Well, and they talk about that a bit in the next issue.
Yes, they do.
We'll get to that. Let's go over the Claw backup feature here. Because this was kind of, again, that second part to finish off both the featurette here in the backup, but also kind of the tale of the character.
Yeah. And to get us caught up, there was, once again, a lot of text in here, a lot of exposition.
Yeah, we got a full page on the history of the curse, which I appreciated, having not really knowing what the hell it was. He's got the demon's hand, but showing how it happened, how both the human and the demon were kind of in trouble with the higher-ups of you know, supernatural power, and both were kind of cursed to have the other's hand.
I like that they told us.
Well, and I liked how the demon considered it, you know, a worthless appendage, and it's weak, and that's why it's his curse.
Yeah, exactly. And while on the flip side, Claw's hand, it actually is quite strong. It can actually almost fight him at times in the usage of it.
Well, yeah, it was... not only an asset to him with the strength, like you said, but the demon seemed to still have some control over it, or it didn't want to fight the demon because it was part of the demon or whatever. It was never fully explained exactly what it is, just what was happening. You know, the hand doesn't want to go hit him with the sword and crap like that. It's like, well, the hand may not, but the arm's gonna make it kind of deal.
Exactly, yeah. So he has control of his arm, but the hand's kind of like, I don't want to kill my master type thing.
And I love how the lady who had explained why the demons were attacking, it's like, these idiot guys. This is stupid. Let's handle it this way.
Yeah, I like that. We're going to have a showdown, or we're going to have... I don't know if you would call it a showdown.
It was a ritual to undo the first.
Yeah, a ritual where they're holding the hands, almost like the same type of thing, but Claw grabs the dagger from the lady's hand and kind of lops his hand off the demon's body to take it back,
mm-hmm.
essentially.
Well, because it was going to be one will survive, the other will die, but who knows which. The fact that this guy realized that he had the demon's hand, but the demon didn't have his hand, but the hand of a long-dead ancestor. So it crumbled to dust once separated from the demon.
That was really cool. I liked the way it ended. And I was like, okay, so is that the end of Claw? That's what I was thinking.
Yes and no. It's end of the Claw backup, as far as I know. But
yes,
the character does show up elsewhere later on in the DCU.
Exactly. As far as I know, right now at this moment, I'm like, oh. And I'm assuming right then that book would have shown up when I go to get the next issue of Warlord. There's Claw sitting there.
Decades later, he shows up.
Oh, decades later. Okay, never mind. I'm lying.
Yeah, I don't know that he showed up again until, I want to say, the aughts or 2010s, maybe?
Yeah.
Maybe sooner? I don't know.
I'll tell you what, I did enjoy it. I thought it was fun.
I liked how it was a good two-part thing of set up the duel, the meeting of the two, resolve it and whatnot, but also do it in a way that I didn't really see coming. And there is a hint at the end where there's a guy saying, oh, just as the Lords of Shadows have decreed, kind of a thing. Like, there's gonna be more? So, playing into the never-ending saga.
Yeah. Now, I was surprised with something when we get to the next issue, the 50th issue.
Okay, let's go hop over there.
Okay, the thing that I was surprised with is I was happy we got a big 27-page, full-on Grell Warlord cover to cover.
Mm-hmm.
But they increased it by another 10 cents, 60 cents. I was like, man, that's a kick in the cojones. You know, they went up on price again. I was like, they've been doing this, but that was the time.
Well, what's more interesting, I think, is that the following issue is also 60 cents.
And not.
And we get the backup and whatnot. But this was the time where we were getting the price hikes and stuff like that. And again, we'd been at 50 cents for a year or two at this point.
Oh, it feels quicker as we read four issues at a time.
It does. But going to a price hike on a bonus size issue and then not reverting to the previous price on the next issue, we've seen Marvel do that in recent years time and time again.
Yeah, yeah. So this was the price hike, but you're getting 27 pages and you get the full Grell for the 50th issue, which was kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. I thought this was a good issue by and large. There were a couple of things they did that I didn't care for. But I like how Travis realizes they've been being followed for the past 10 miles, and let's prepare a welcome for them.
Yeah, I like that. And it was our friends. This was like a getting the band back together in the most violent way possible.
Well, Travis realizes the guy he's about to stab is Eitan, and that, you know, Tara and Shakira are going at it. And she's like, oh, that's enough. And Tara's like, nope, it's not. And winds up getting decked as Shakira morphs into the cat and gets out of the way.
Yeah, Shakira sees the punch coming and turns into a cat, and Travis takes it right to the chin. Boom.
Which is a nice callback to the last time they saw each other, and he's like, I'm tired of getting slugged every time we meet.
Yeah, that's funny. So funny.
It was a well-done moment, but I also liked how we got that Travis is still haunted by the death of their son.
Yeah, they went back to that, and he's like, I killed him, and they turned the whole palette, the color palette, blue. He's just still grieving over, he thinks he's killed his son at this point.
Yeah. Now, we know he's still alive, but they don't.
Yeah. And this 50th issue, when I say we're getting the band back together, we got Eitan, Tara, Shakira, Travis, and then immediately you flip the page and you're getting the other characters. Everyone's kind of in this book, which is cool.
Yeah, because Mongo is getting the letter that Sargon from the lower third or whatever the previous issue had been at the tail end of writing. So we get Mongo, Machiste, and Mariah back in the Wizards era thousands of years in the past. So for 50th issue, you know, bringing everybody into the game is kind of cool.
Yeah, so this was like a fun issue because all the characters you love, instead of seeing them in separate groupings, let's say, you're reading them all in the same issue. It feels like everyone's starting to come back together at this point.
Well, and to add to that, we also get Ashiya, or whatever, the witch.
Yep.
And she was from issue, I want to say 10 or whatever, the hag that was the one posing as the young one to go get the mask of life or whatever it was.
Yeah, she was really good looking until she showed her true form and then, ugh.
And I love how Demios is like, the mask of life is my curse.
Yes.
He's cursed to live. That's how come he came back. He can't die.
Yep. Yep. He's more than a cat. This guy can't die. And he's at this point stuck with no body, just a head and a hand.
But he's got a plan.
Yes, he does. There's always a way.
And he's also decided, because he's basically like mesmerized Jennifer and decided she'll make a good consort, which the witch does not seem to approve of.
Yeah, the witch is not happy with that at all. But he knows she's an old hag, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And his plan is to cast a spell with her help to make a pact with the evil one, which is the bad guy we saw in the ancient times, again, at the bottom of the last issue and stuff.
Exactly, which I'm assuming is a placeholder, the evil one for Lucifer, the devil, something like that.
Exactly, exactly.
He's got hooves and wings, so, and he's red.
Yeah, yeah, definitely seems to fit that. So they cast the spell. What is left of Demios gets sent back. The evil one is like, wow, somebody really doesn't like you. And Demios basically bargains to get his body restored. And he'll do anything in exchange for that.
You never say that to a demon or to the devil. I'll do anything.
You to never get my say that to any super powerful being.
No, you'll do anything. Haha. That leaves it open to a lot of interpretation.
And I love how as soon as Demios gets restored to his living body and stuff, in Rush, Machiste, Mariah, and Mongo to take care of things.
Yep.
And they quickly get Sargon kind of on their side, because again, Sargon had been taken prisoner by the Evil One last issue. And then when the two wizards of Sargon and Mongo are actually doing decently against the Evil One, he's like, well, I need a power up. I'm going to take Demios' power.
Reaches into his chest and grabs it out. That was awesome.
And he's like, what? It's like, you said I could have anything.
Yeah.
And then he apparently just banishes him back to his own time.
Yeah, with no powers at all, he's just a random dude, a random guy.
It's like, damn.
I like that.
And then the evil one, basically, it's like, okay, you've won the skirmish, I'll win the war kind of a deal, and flies off. So I'm assuming at some point we're going to have another Wizard World thing with that guy getting dealt with in some way.
Yeah, exactly. Something has to happen here, and I don't know where it's going to happen, but it's got to be coming up. It has to.
Yeah. And then we cut to Demios being hurled back to his time and then realizing he's powerless and that Travis is coming.
Yeah. And when he finds out Travis is coming, he's now feeling powerless, you know, because he doesn't have his wizarding abilities, and turns to the witch, Aisha.
Yeah.
And she's like, you change as quickly as a snake shedding its skin, because he's all of a sudden not dependent on her. Hey, I'll make you my queen, sweetie. You know, he doesn't say sweetie, but you know, hey, you're the one I always wanted.
Uh-huh.
And And she's like, I'm out of here, you know, forget you. And by the way, his son's really alive, which was kind of awesome, because there's the reveal to him, to Demios.
Yep. He's like, that's impossible. I saw Travis slay the son. Oh, it was just a clone that died. I took the real baby, living with a woodcutter's family now.
Yeah, and her name's Ashia, but I always call her Aisha. I mix that name up all the time.
Oh, I'm probably butchering half the names. They don't have a pronunciation guide.
They don't.
So she takes off and leaves him alone.
Which I did like. I liked that she stood up for herself, kind of not letting herself get run over after he tossed her aside earlier.
Oh, absolutely. He had this perfect. Coming 6 ways to Sunday.
Yep.
And as Eitan, Tara, Travis, and Shakira head into the castle, we end a page on the sights of a gun, the next page, and Eitan is getting blasted by, I guess, an energy bazooka.
Yeah. Demios is going to have to fight the way that, with only the tools that he can use, which is energy weapons or swords or things like that, because he doesn't have any power. So he's using energy bazooka.
Yeah, using the technology available to him. Now, what annoyed me here is they kill off Anton.
I did not like that. I was kind of upset.
I think there's a ton of stories they could have done with him later in terms of Eitan and Jennifer. Do they get along? Do they not? One's a son type figure to Travis. The other's the actual daughter.
Yeah.
If and when Eitan would have ever met Joshua / Tinder and stuff, the actual son, would they have been buddies? Would they have been rivals? What would have happened? And then those three going adventuring together of Eitan, Joshua, and Jennifer could have been fun, but not to be had.
Yeah, this was an impactful issue because I did like the character. I kept on waiting for him to be grazed and wounded and not dead, but he's toast.
Yeah, the blast goes straight through his chest.
Yeah.
And it spooks Tara's horse, so she's out of the picture, you know, for a bit. And Shakira is busy making sure Tara doesn't get blasted. Well, Travis takes his pistol out and goes after Demios.
Yeah, and Demios, on top of having his energy weapons, has Travis's daughter.
Human shield, literally, yeah.
Human shield, she's right in front. Hey, you really want to do this type thing? And his eyes are shown as red. He's just seeing red, ready to kill.
Oh, yeah.
At this point.
Yeah. And I love at this point, Falderon, the guy who'd been with Jennifer the whole time, is like, nope, you're not going to hurt her. She's a friend.
I love that twist, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. He gets redemption for the panel. He's pulling her away to the next panel where he's getting blasted in half by the bazooka.
Yeah. I mean, Falderon's been like a henchman and just a guy who's used by Demios. You know, he respected Demios because he had power, but he spent so much time with this girl, Jennifer, that he's grown to like her, and you're not hurting her. And I love that he flipped on his own master to save the girl.
Well, and that gives Travis the opening he needs to shoot the bazooka, which kind of blows up, knocks Demios down, and Demios, I think, steals Eitan's horse.
Yeah, that's the way I took it, too. Stole Eitan's horse.
And seems to be kicking Shakira on the way out. So, I mean, this guy's no good.
Yeah, and there's the touching moment where Travis is holding Eitan in his arms, just saying he's dead. He never had a chance. You know, he's the best, you know, on and on. And that's really sad because you want to see Eitan again and he's gone.
Well, and then Travis tells Shakira, keep an eye on Tara and Jennifer. He hops on his horse and he's going to take Demios to hell.
Yeah, and one thing it makes sense, but it also doesn't make sense. He's going after the guy alone. But once they get the team together, he always goes off on his own. And I was thinking, oh my God, here he goes. He's going to leave for another adventure and we won't see the rest of the group for months. But we don't know that right now. And I'm thinking he should have brought Shakira with him because she's a fighter too, just as a little bit of backup. That was just me.
I don't think so because Tara was still dazed. Jennifer's in an unknown state. He needs he can trust to keep an eye on those two.
That's true, and he does trust Shakira, and she can take care of herself.
And she wanted to go with him, but again, it goes to the relationship those two have.
Yeah, they respect each other, and that makes sense, yeah, with their conditions. That's true.
But then we cut to Travis going across, it looks like, the winter tundra or whatever, having grabbed a cloak from somewhere, and I don't know how long he spends chasing Demios till he finds the horse and eventually finds Demios almost getting picked apart by a pack of wolves.
Yeah, and at this point I was like, why is he saving him from the wolves? Let him be.
Great splash page of him taking the wolves off of Demios.
That was really cool, and this is something that looks like it could be out of Conan here with him picking up the wolves, stabbing them. Conan, he typically fights a lot of big apes, but yeah, animals, so there you go.
So he he literally saves Demios. There's a wreck of a ship nearby, drags him in there, starts a fire. The wolves have backed off, but they're still in the area thinking, mealtime soon. And then Demios wakes up. Travis is all set to just shoot him and decides not to. Puts the gun away and walks off, dousing the fire.
Yeah, it was kind of funny. Like, not funny. He was watching them being eaten. Demios saves him, revitalizes him, and wants him to know, essentially, I'm going to allow you to be eaten.
Because as soon as he kicks out the fire and leaves, the dogs or the wolves or whatever come in and just devour.
And there can't be a way for Demios to come back now. I mean, you probably know, but I'm thinking he's basically being devoured. He'll be in the excrement soon. I hope he's not alive.
Now, this is a learning opportunity for people, I think, of never trust secondary sources.
Yes.
This is described in Wikipedia and some other sources as Morgan and Demios enter combat for the last time. Demios was killed and his head thrown to a wolf pack.
What?
That is absolutely not what happens here.
He had his whole body at this point.
And it's like, yeah, they had entered into combat, but that was previous Morgan saves him and then lets him get taken by the pack of wolves and fend for himself. If Demios had been able to take out the wolves, he would have survived.
Interesting.
So you always got to take what you find on either Wikipedia, other websites, YouTube videos, whatever, with a grain of salt. Sometimes they get it right. Sometimes they misinterpret. I'm looking at this and I read that and I'm like, that does not match.
Yeah, that didn't match at all.
And this is an interesting moment, I think, for Morgan, because he was the better man.
He really was. He was the better man. I think he did the right thing. And I'm excited to see, when I went to the 51st issue, I was like, I want to see him get back with the group and see them play this out. And I was a little bit disappointed when I went to the 51st issue.
Yeah, the 51st issue is a reprinting of the first issue.
Yeah, I was like, no!
Now, issue 51 came out in July of 1981. That first issue it's reprinting was from October 1975.
Yeah.
Now, comic stores existed at this point, but fewer and further between than they are now. Not guaranteed to have the back issues. There were no such thing as trade paperbacks in the day. So while some of the stuff would get reprinted in the, you know, almost 4x6 digest size or whatever the DC Blue Ribbon Digest and Adventure Comics and all those things were at, the only way to read the issues was to find the issues, by and large.
Yeah, this issue literally is a product of the time. It's like going into a time warp and realizing, like you said, that there weren't really trade paperbacks. Their comic shops were few and far between. There were comic shops, but there weren't tons and tons of them. And this was probably some people their first time seeing Warlord number one when they got issue 51.
This is kind of the equivalent, roughly, not exactly, but roughly, of the facsimile editions we have today.
That's a perfect way of putting it. And to not be, okay, 60 cents is a little bit overpriced for a reprint.
We do get a backup feature.
But there's a backup feature. So the backup feature, for the people who were buying, it's like the ultimate. And like, let's say I was a Warlord fan from issue one and I have all 50. Man, I got to get 51 because they gave me a new backup of Dragon Sword. And if I don't pick this up, I'm going to miss out on the new thing.
Yeah. This was also around the time frame that DC was doing double-sized comics that were reprinting some classic Batman stories, some of the original Deadman stuff, the Hard Traveling Heroes for Green Arrow, Green Lantern, things of that sort.
Ah, okay.
So kind of a precursor to what would become the trade stuff later, but not exactly the trades. Because it would be two issues per kind of a thing.
That makes sense. Now, I'll tell you what, on issue 51, I really like the cover, you know, seeing Warlord, there he is. But I'm reminded again how different he looks now when we first saw him in that black, almost like a unitard thing or something. I like the way he looks like today versus how he was originally cast. I like the helmet, you know, the clothes he's wearing. I just like the garb a little bit more than this black with just a skull on it.
Yeah, I agree. I think the original outfit was not great. They at least kept the bracelets, gauntlets, whatever.
Yeah.
I do think it would be interesting at some point, because he's got this skull armor thing over his, I guess, right shoulder that goes down to the belt or whatever on the left and stuff.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting at some point if he were to take that off and be able to use it either like a grappling hook or a melee weapon or something.
It seems like it's something he could swing around his head and hit people. Or like you said, a grappling hook. It seems like it could be very usable, but we haven't seen it used.
I think that would have been a wild thing for them to have done, is basically he's setting up what his stuff's going to be, and he sets it all up to have kind of a dual purpose, because again, he plans ahead or something.
Yeah, it's a ranged weapon almost at that point.
Yeah, that would have been wild. Again, great cover. And I also appreciated the one on 50, where we had the main cover, but then on the sides, kind of sketches of most of the cast from the last 50 issues that were recurring.
Yeah, I agree. That one was great, too. It was just kind of, I had forgotten when I flipped it. I was like, oh yeah, his costume was way different. And I think he's markedly improved. So I really like the new costume. And it took me back. I read it and I was like, oh yeah, I remember this stuff. This is good. So much stuff happened in that first issue.
Yeah. It was some great stuff. And I think it reads well on its own. And even better if you'd read the first issue special number 8 or whatever it was that actually launched the property.
Yeah. Now, the backup story with Dragon Sword, where we got Paul Levitz writing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to say it's kind of in the same vein, the same genre, but there was a silliness thing to it. because with the talking animals.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We've got Thyron, who's going to be a dragon slayer, I guess, and his Decilius or whatever, his monkey squire?
Yeah, I was like, oh my gosh. This is one of the backup stories where I'm like, it got a little too silly where I didn't enjoy it as much. Yeah, Decilius the talking chimp.
Do we know when and where this is set?
I don't think it really told us. I'm looking at the first page right now, and it doesn't really tell us where it took place.
I would be tempted to set this near the end of the Great Disaster era.
Yeah, it seems like it's a story that takes place in the DCU versus the others do not. Yeah, the other stories we've read.
Yeah, yeah. Well, OMAC does.
OMAC does, yeah.
Alternate future, yeah. Whatever, but not Claw or...
Arrak, or...
I think they established later Arrak was part of the thing, but... I mean, to me, this would have been a second Middle Ages kind of a deal.
Yeah, like I haven't really read much of the character, but I'm looking at this, I'm like, oh, Paul Levitt's apparently like Detective Chimp. He likes talking chimps. And I'm not saying this is a bad thing. I was like, it got a little silly for me. I was like, as soon as the animals are talking, I'm like, okay, this is weird.
I took it as lighthearted.
Yeah, lighthearted.
Nod to Planet of the Apes, and again, some of the great disasters where you had talking animals and stuff like that, anthropomorphic. But I don't know that there's much to Dragonsword other than these four backups that this is the first of four of.
Wow, so that's pretty much it.
There is a later, well, I guess that's a later Claw that was a member of Primal Force, maybe. We might see the sword later, I don't know. I could be wrong, I'm not that familiar with Dragonsword. I don't know how much more there is to it than this.
Yeah, even the dragon talks in here, but it wasn't a bad story. It's just, it was a little bit different, you know, just different.
Definitely different tone and style. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I did like how the dragon slayer slayed the dragon.
I thought that was interesting, and the bit at the end where he's at the pub telling the tale of I'm a dragon slayer and stuff, but that's not where the story ends. He pulls out the sword, and the sword starts talking.
That, I was like, okay, we're going off the deep end here. All right.
Because essentially, it takes the entire first installment to get to kind of the premise point of the talking sword with the dragon in it and stuff.
Exactly. It just got a little weird for me at this point. I was like, okay, this is different. It just felt so different than anything we've read. And it, not in a bad way, just not what I was expecting.
I kind of like this better than a Claw, certainly better than OMAC and stuff, and better than Arrak. But I thought it had a sense of fun to it without being too wacky.
Yeah, you know, I can see what you're saying there. I don't want to say I didn't enjoy it. I enjoyed it. It was just like, we got these almost like realistic takes with Arrak and with Claw.
Mm.
And I was in that vein. I was like, oh, cool, dragon fighting. And then when they started talking, I was like, okay, we're getting a little wacky here. What's going on? So it just felt different, but it wasn't bad. I just was off from the other stuff I read before.
Oh, absolutely. The other two, Claw and Arrak, are very much in that Conan vein. This is not.
Yeah. So getting into out of that mindset, this was fun for what it was.
Yeah, I thought this was a lot of fun. It was entertaining. I'm curious where it goes and stuff. And, you know, Paul Levitz, I think, is a very good writer. He was doing Legion at this point, among other things. And this is him doing, a fantasy-esque sort of deal. Again, dragon slaying and all that. But, you know, being a bit lighthearted with it without ridiculing the genre or the premise.
Yeah, it was almost like a palate cleanser.
Yeah.
At that point, from the hyper-realistic type stuff that you read with Warlord, typically. And I don't want to say hyper-realistic because we're dealing with Atlantis and dinosaurs, but you know what I mean.
This was a more happy-go-lucky.
Exactly, yeah. Much lighter tone.
But I would say it was still a little more serious than when we had the Wizard World stuff with Mongo and we're doing all these riffs on Tolkien and stuff like that.
That's true, and definitely more, a little more depth to it than that.
Yeah.
Not as comical.
But I could see where somebody would be a little frustrated in terms of, do I get this issue or not because it's a reprint of something they may already have, but do I want the backup or not? It's a new backup. I don't know. At least it was a new backup versus if it was the end of something you knew you wanted or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And going into it, you didn't know if you liked this Paul Levitt story. You didn't know if you liked Dragon Slayer. So this was completely new and you're paying the full 60 cents. So a buyer at the time, some of them might have loved it, some of them might have felt ripped off. Who knows?
Well, keep in mind, though, this was the era in which you were reading stuff or picking stuff up off the rack.
Yep.
You had the chance to go flip through it, realize you'd read all of it, be able to see it was Paul Levitz, flip through the couple of pages before you had to make your decision.
Very true. Yeah.
It's not like you're ordering it 2-3 months in advance like some of us do today.
Yeah. But honestly, you almost have to order in advance now because if you go to a lot of comic stores, they don't keep a lot of rack copies.
Yeah, it's a totally different era.
You either have to tell them, I want this, put it in my box, you know, my pull box, or there may not be any copies when you go show up.
Yeah, it would be interesting to get a sense of, at your average store, at some selection of stores or whatever, what's the odds of you going in on the end of a Wednesday or the end of a Friday or on a Saturday, you know, whatever, and being able to find new issues of stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, before I switched to, oh, what was it, DCBS, and then I went to Eric over at Deep Discount Comics, Cowabunga, I used to go into the comic shop and I would pick up stuff. And I remember they only had what I would deem the most popular Image titles, which at that time was not Spawn, you know. Spawn was not the most popular. It was like East of West was coming out at that time, mm-hmm. I think. And just like a few big names, there might have been like 10 Image titles. So if you wanted one of those, I'm picking something, it wasn't coming out, Ice Cream Man, and it was kind of obscure, they just didn't buy it unless you told them to buy it for you. So you wouldn't have seen it.
If you're, as a retailer, paying roughly, you know, half the cover price and stuff to get a copy, you know, you've got to sell 2 copies to kind of break even and start making money at some point. It's math's a little more than that because there's shipping, overhead of the building, you know, staff, yada, yada. But if it's something that you're going to get and it's going to sit on the shelf, it's always been bad business.
Oh, yeah. And it's way easier to buy a copy of, oh, okay, this big name writer is writing this big name book. I'll buy a couple extra copies for the rack versus who the hell is this guy? I haven't heard of him or this lady. I don't know. And most of the people coming here aren't going to know. And can I really hand sell it? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe they have time. Maybe it sits there. Maybe someone buys it and they feel burned. You know, who knows?
Well, at roughly this time, and it was actually probably going to be 3 or 4 years later, actually. This is still middle of 1981 here.
Yeah.
So say 83 to 85-ish, maybe 86. I was working at a shop and helping the owner when he, on the Saturdays, come and do the order for the next thing. Now, at mid-80s, when you did that, you had the printed physical order form. He had a hand calculator, and it's like, okay, since I was the young kid working there, he'd have me go walk over to the rack, count how many issues of Wonder Woman or Flash or X-Men or whatever was left. It's like, okay, he ordered X, he's got this, and here is what that diamond or, you know, index is or whatever, you know, giving a sense of nationally, is it selling well, is it not? And it was either the Diamond or it might have even been the Capital City one at the time. Anyways, and I was asking one time, why are you not getting more copies of Wonder Woman? It's like, okay, go count how many of each issue we have. And this was when you had the rack, and it had a slot for the book that was maybe an inch deep.
Okay.
And I went through, I think, the last maybe 6 to 12 issues. It was like one copy of each. And he's like, yep, one copy of each. Bought 3. He took one, I bought the other, that's the third.
Wow. And you and him were the only two actually buying it and taking it home.
Not worth taking a chance on. And he's like, do I get the third copy or not?
Yeah.
You can't sell something you don't got. But if you're depending the discount you're getting and stuff like that, that was killing the profit on the title for him.
Yeah. So him keeping even that one extra shelf copy was probably the difference between profitability and a loss or a break even at that point.
There was one difference then to now.
What is that?
He had a back issue collection and was selling back issues, and that was a viable business back then.
Ah, and back issues now are really not that. I mean,
it's a niche market because so many people can either get the trade, read it online, or just not read it.
Yeah, I can read it digitally. I have Marvel Unlimited or DC Infinite Ultra.
Yep.
Yeah, so they don't go searching for it unless they're the completionist. That all makes sense. All right. I gotcha.
So it's interesting because, again, this is still the era when, while there were comic stores, some of them would do a pull service. That was still few and far between. A lot of the people that were reading these things were reading them off the spinner rack or picking them up off, you know, 7-Eleven, the grocery store, the liquor store, or whatever.
Ah, that makes me laugh, the liquor store.
Yeah.
I mean, I heard about it in Robservations and all that stuff, but you can just imagine the kids walking into the liquor store. That's awesome. To buy their comics.
When I was growing up in San Diego, and this is a tangent and I know it, there was the comic store out in the suburbs that I worked at and shopped at. There was the grocery store my mom shopped at that had a spinner rack, and I'd get some stuff there. There was a 7-Eleven or two I would frequent to get some comics. And then next to the smaller grocery store that also had the barbershop we'd go to, there was a liquor store, and sometimes I'd get one or two there.
That's just funny, you know?
Yeah.
Let's market to the kids here at the liquor store. just different times.
Well, if you've got a newsstand and the people running the newsstand are putting it on there.
There you go.
It's not like the people running the liquor store are picking the comics to put there.
That's true. Just so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally different era that this stuff was published in.
I used to go to the convenience store. I'd tuck the comics into my front of my pants and ride my bike back home. They're probably all bent to hell when I got home, but I'd read them. You know, I just bought them to read.
Well, if you like look at the cover of any one of these issues, and for a lot of comics of this era, right about where the top of the Warlord logo would be, about an inch and a half or whatever down.
Yeah.
On that left side, there'd usually be a pretty big dent in it or fold or whatever.
That's from kids like me.
From the spinner rack.
From the spinner racks, that's true, hanging over. And the
people would
from the
pull
metal.
It forward to see what was behind it.
Oh, man. Yeah. Yep. Man.
Spinner racks were horrible for comics, but that was the venue.
Well, I mean, and when I was young, comics were, even they were collectible. When I was real young, I just bought them to read them. I didn't even think about collectibility, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It wasn't until we get a little bit older, we're like, oh, take care of them, you know? I don't remember when that happened to me or why, but you started doing it. But honestly, there's something to that disposability. You know, I like getting my previews and all that. And I respect that you and several others collect your previews. You have them. Me, I just throw mine in the recycle bin. I'm like, that's a bygone era. People don't do that anymore, as I throw them in my recycle bin.
Well, if you've got no need for them, it makes sense. But
yeah. I mean, I've just always gotten rid of them because I was like, they're just catalogs. And now it's too far gone. I've been doing it for years, so I'm not going to start collecting them now.
Now, one thing I did want to point out about the four issues we talked about this time.
Yeah.
There was no mention of Mykola Rostov that was introduced in 47.
Oh, yeah. I remember.
So he was the wolf man or whatever.
Yeah.
I am sure we'll see him sooner or later, probably sooner. But it was interesting that we went really three issues because this 51 was a reprint of number one.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll see him before too long. I just don't remember how long.
Yeah. But I mean, in real time, that might have been like a 6-month break before you see that character.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
Anything else?
No, that does it for me.
Cool.
Recording clips for the preview spotlight episodes is easy, and we've got an open submission policy for these episodes. Please send in clips to support the comics you love as often as you can. If you'd like to get email reminders for the preview spotlight episodes, you can join the emailing list on the main page of the comicbookpage.com website. The deadline is typically the second Saturday of the month at 9 a.m. Check the main page of the website for more information and the exact deadline for the next preview spotlight.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.